A brief warning before we get started. Toward the end of this interview, there's some conversation that gets into accusations of sexual assault, including some graphic descriptive terms. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. David Sedaris first became widely known as a humorist and storyteller with the broadcast of his story, The Santaland Diaries. That was in 1992, 30 years ago. Santaland Diaries is a recollection of his time spent as a costumed elf at Macy's during Christmas. And it's hysterically funny, made him a star. It's so funny that it's easy to miss in that essay the pain that he expresses, the poverty, the humiliation of the whole thing. The anger in that story is a bit easier to notice. The shopper who says she's going to have him fired, to which he thinks, quote, "Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. I'm going to have you fired, and I want to lean over and say, I'm going to have you killed," unquote. Notably, he wants to lean over and say that, but he doesn't because he can't because he needs the job. He wants to speak his anger, but is prevented from doing so by life circumstances. And then 30 years pass, and here we are today at the publication of David's new book, the somewhat deceptively titled Happy-Go-Lucky. David is not poor anymore, not by a long shot. He's written numerous best-selling books. He tours the world, speaking to large audiences that adore him. There is a lot of pain, though, also, in Happy-Go-Lucky. He writes about his father's death in 2021 and about a lot of very difficult memories related to his father that he didn't want to share until Lou Sedaris was gone. David talks about the death by suicide of his sister Tiffany in 2013 and accusations she made against her father and David before her death. An earlier essay about Tiffany's death, Now We Are Five, appeared in The New Yorker, and David talked about the pain and frustration of dealing with an unstable family member. David was criticized by Tiffany's friends for being too callous and not being more supportive while she was alive. Happy-Go-Lucky is funny. It's often very funny. And he talks about all kinds of things, including the isolation of the pandemic, which he spent part of living in New York with Hugh, his boyfriend of many years. David Sedaris was supposed to be in a studio when I interviewed him, but a day or two before the interview, he tested positive for COVID. So he was in his apartment with his assistant over Zoom. Later in the interview, there's a very frightening pounding sound that he and I have to come to grips with.
The other day, I was supposed to go on television and I had to take a COVID test and it was positive. And I just finished a 42-city tour. And I guess I felt a little bit tired, but I thought it was just because I had just finished the tour. But other than that, I felt normal. So, yeah, I kind of felt left out because I felt special because I never got COVID. You know, I went to 72 cities in the fall and I just went to 42 cities. And that's pretty remarkable to go to all those places and not get it. I can't complain. You know, I have it, but I can't complain.
The symptoms aren't too bad.
No, I thought maybe I developed seasonal allergies later on in my life. So my nose runs a little bit, but I thought it was pollen or something like that. I really honestly would not have noticed anything was off, but I'm not really in touch with my body. You know, like people are, like they'll say, oh my God, I had a Brussels sprout with maple syrup on it. And I was like speeding all afternoon. And I don't notice things like that. I mean, I notice big things like, wow, I have a kidney stone. But I don't notice like subtle highs and lows with my body.
In the new book, there's a lot of talk about being stuck at home because of COVID and that being hard for you to, because you like to be out on the road, or at least you're used to it. How are you handling that aspect? Are you canceling dates that you have coming up?
No, this is the perfect time for me to be sick because, like I said, in the fall, I went to 72 cities and then finished like December 17th. And then I did a bunch of shows in January, and then I just went to 42 cities, and then I have a week off, and then I start a book tour. So perfect time to be sick. And then I'll just go on tour again. And then the whole month of July, I'm on a tour in the UK. So I'm making up for lost time. I love it.
Yeah, you tour a lot. Why do you tour so much?
I think I like the attention. Yeah. I think I'm my best self when I'm on tour. I'm in the moment. I think I'm kinder than I normally am. I'm more observant. Yeah, I think the best me has a suitcase in his hand.
What did all that time away during the pandemic, all that time away from the road do to you mentally then?
When I look back on it, you know, I mean, I keep a diary, so I can, you know, it's pretty easy for me to look back on it and with clarity. But sometimes when you're in something, it's a little bit harder to see it. But I just think of it as such a dark time. I guess just dark because all of the reasons for living in New York City were gone, right? All of the reasons, you know, the cultural life, you know, the museums and the theater and stuff, all that was shut down. And so it was just, I mean, luckily my sister is here and my boyfriend Hugh was here, but most people left town, you know, or most people in my neighborhood left town. So it just sort of felt kind of empty and bleak. And I'm lucky I could work at home. Maybe I could write at home. So at least I got a lot of writing done. It was one of those things where usually, I mean, I figured out pretty early on that I didn't have anything to complain about. It was one of those situations where you're like, okay, you win. And there was a real sense, I feel, during the pandemic of like, you figured out pretty early that there was always somebody who had it worse than you. And those were the most vocal people. And I'm like, yeah, okay, you got a point. You know, you're living in a studio apartment with three kids. You know, you win. Uh-huh. I have nothing to say here.
Well, you talked about how being on the road, that's your best self. What was it like to spend all that time with someone who wasn't your best self?
Well, I wasn't as awful as I thought I was going to be. You know, I mean, I wasn't as bad company as I thought I was going to be. I mean, the thing is, Hugh and I have been together for 31 years, but we're not together much. You know, I mean, I'm usually gone at least half a year. So I hadn't spent that much time with him. And I was afraid that we would get on each other's nerves horribly. But we didn't. I was really surprised by that. I was surprised by how well, we got along. There was not a single night that one of us slept on the sofa, or I don't recall a single fight. You know, you have a little argument over what's for dinner, but then a fight. And it was really great to spend, you know, I have a sister, Amy, who lives in New York, and I've been in Europe for, you know, 20 years. So it was really great to be able to spend a lot of time with her. You know, I absolutely have nothing to
complain about.
And I even, you know, now that I have it, I still can't complain. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just so mild. It's like going to jail, but just for like 10 minutes. And other people are on death row or they've got long sentences and, you know, they've got a lot they can really, and you're just like, you know, just there for 10 minutes. The bunk was a little bit hard, but I didn't have to sleep on it, you know, just sat on it for a few minutes while my roommate talked about his life. Everything's fine.
Yeah. I had a friend who had to spend 48 hours in a county jail. And I said, what did you do? He said, well, we watched a lot of Alf. We just sat there and watched Alf because there was an Alf marathon on.
I get so many letters from people in prison. Do you get a lot of mail from people in prison?
I don't know. What's unique about the letters you get from prison?
I mean, I think when word gets out that you answer your mail, a lot of people in prison start writing you. And I'm happy to write people back. The problem is they don't have a lot of other stuff to do. So you'll write somebody and then they write you back that afternoon. So you're constantly in debt. You know, it's not like they sit on the letter for a few months and then they answer it. So
you're in a relationship with them at that point.
Well, you know, they always usually they found my books in the prison library. And, you know, it's just something you don't think about. I was doing a reading and this guy came and he brought one of my books with him to solitary. And he was in there for months. Can you imagine? I always thought that if I were in solitary confinement, I'm like, okay, give me the Bible. You know, like, yeah. I'll finally read it.
Complete Shakespeare or something.
Yeah. There's certain books you just have to be in prison to, for me anyway, to read them, right? Like Ulysses, you know, I'd have to be in prison in order to do it. But the thought of someone giving your book that much attention, it's really humbling, I think.
Which of your books was it?
I think it was When You Were Engulfed in Flames.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Huh. Good choice. This just makes me think of the idea of how you relate to the idea of being around people, because you talk about this best self when you're out on the road, and you mentioned the presence or absence of people when you were in New York. And I wonder how much that is tied to growing up and this idea of a big family, a mostly close family, and then touring exhaustively. Do you think that those comforts of adulthood come from a crowded house as a kid?
Oh gosh, that's something I never thought about. I mean, I'm alone when I write, you know, writing calls for solitude. So, but I always thought of that going on tour as my reward for all those hours of solitude. And I do like being around people, but then when there's a break between tours, usually I don't know, I guess I just sort of welcome that. I guess just because when you're on tour like that, you're always on. You always have to be on. You can't not be. Again, I like right now, I'm off for another week and I'm writing things. And when I write them, I just imagine an audience reacting to them. And you know, I'm anticipating that, but I need this time in order to make the other time happen.
Well, you write in the book about meeting an author at one point who wasn't on, and you were younger and you had them sign your book and they didn't even look at you, and it made you really, really mad. And so the option to not be on when you're meeting people is there, but it seems like a fundamental part of you is opposed to the idea of being aloof in those situations.
Well, because I don't know, I just always remember what it's like to be on the other side of the table. And you're standing in line and you're thinking, what am I going to say? Everything I've said, he's heard before. And I just see my job. It's like being a host, you know, it's being a gracious host. And you see that somebody is nervous and you set them at ease. That's your job as a host, to relax them and to make them feel at home. And I think I'm good at it. You know?
Yeah.
And what makes me good at it is I know what it's like to be them. Same thing is knowing what it's like to sit in the theater, right? Remembering what it's like to sit in the theater. It's good to keep that in your mind when you're just... I was on stage a while ago, and what happened is I was in Arizona, and I went for a walk, and I didn't realize how hot it was. It was over 100 degrees. And so I just walked for an hour. But then when it came time to go to the theater, I was just felt stoned. I just... And I felt drained of energy. And I got on stage and I heard this person rambling on about beaver tails. And I thought, oh my God, that's me. That was me. And I was just so out of it. Beaver tails are a woman's breasts when they get stretched out, when she's old and they're stretched out.
Oh, okay.
Bridget Everett calls those beaver tails. And I laughed so hard. And I told somebody that at the book signing one night, and they said, you mean spaniel ears?
Wow.
There has to be a corresponding term with an old man's testicles.
Oh, yeah. With the dangling, there's got to be. Now, I just think of that, the Fleetwood Mac album cover where Mick Fleetwood has this, wearing some garment with long dangling balls ornamentally placed on the bottom of it. It's always haunted me because, like, I just wanted to listen to Rhiannon and now I'm thinking of mixed testicles. Well, talking about writing, obviously you write a lot about your family. When I first interviewed you many years ago, I think it was your sister Lisa was on tour with you, and I invited her to come into the studio and be part of the interview. And she said, no, David does that. I don't do that. And it was, I was disappointed, but it was one of the more fascinating moments of the interview, I think. Do you write to try to make sense of your family? Are you trying to reveal truths to yourself or others by writing about them?
No, I think there's a difference between, a good person and a good character. I mean, often good people can be good characters, but there's a kind of a person, like Hugh is a good character, my boyfriend Hugh. My friend, my best friend Ronnie is not a good character. She's a fantastic person, but she's not a good character, right? That's often the case. But I feel like the people in my family are good characters. And what makes them good to write about is that they're good sports as well. You know, I know a lot of people are like, I can't believe the stuff you write. But it's all stuff that people in my family think is funny. You know, I don't want to expose anyone's secrets. I don't want to make them uncomfortable. I don't want to, you know, it's stuff you have to think about. Like if you talk about taking a lot of drugs with someone in your family and they still have a job, you know, then you have to worry that maybe their boss is going to start drug testing them or something like that. So it's stuff I didn't think about when I very first started writing, you know, but as time goes by, I realize, oh, that's a consideration. A bigger problem is that I think a lot of readers, you know, I know particularly my brother, Paul, people really responded to the essays that I wrote about him. And so they'll go up to him and say, do the rooster, like do that thing. And that essay came out 20 years ago. And my brother deserves to grow. He deserves to progress as a person and become a different person. But that essay kind of traps him in amber in a way that I hadn't expected and he hadn't expected either, and that he's uncomfortable with, and I can't blame him.
Coming up, David Sedaris loses a father and gains a lot of freedom to talk honestly about his father. Back with David Sedaris, author of most recently Happy Go Lucky. It's his first book since his father died last year at age 98. The portrayal of your father in Happy Go Lucky, the new book, it feels like a side of your father that I hadn't really read about in the other books as much. There's more of a darkness to it, I think, and there's more revelation about it. Was that because he had died that you felt comfortable writing more of that?
Yeah. I mean, my father was another one of those people. He was a really good character, you know, but he wasn't a good person, you know, but he was good to write about. And in my writing, I always kind of felt like I made him, oh, he's such a nut. Oh, he's wacky. Look, he'll say anything. But in real life, that stuff was really damaging and hurtful. And I didn't have a good relationship with him. I mean, I could, you know, I would call and I would write letters and I would, you know, I didn't ever cut him off. I never said, like, look, I never want to see you or talk to you again, because I didn't want to be one of those people, you know, who are, I mean, I understand the need that certain people have to divorce themselves from their family, but it comes at a pretty, pretty big cost, you know? I remember I worked for this guy when I was like 20 years old, and he said, I'm not your father. And I was like, ugh. Like, I didn't.
Wow. Like,
and I thought it was kind of unfair of him to pull that out, because I don't know what he thought I was asking him for. But I think, well, I don't know, you know, just don't most people who, maybe I'm wrong, go into show business, you know, just, you know, there's just a sort of bottomless desire for applause, for approval, and there's no amount that's enough. You know what I mean? Like if you go and you do a show and you get a standing ovation, it's like fine and everything, but then you want one the next night and the next.
Yeah. It's empty calories.
Yeah. But I thought too, you know, like when you're writing about real people, sometimes things don't make sense to a reader because you don't want to reveal people's secrets, right? So you're not saying, for example, you know, when my sister Tiffany was alive, she'd asked me never to write about her. And I said, okay. And then she said, will you write an essay about me? Everyone thinks you don't like me. So I wrote something about her and I sent it to her. And she's like, you know, she gave her approval and she said she really liked it and she thought it was funny and her friends thought it was funny. And then when the book came out, then she gave an interview saying I had betrayed her and I had written, you know, stolen her life. And anyway, but she had some, you know, some serious problems with anxiety and depression. But I didn't put any of that in the essay. And I think a lot of people reading it would think, wait a minute, why would a person behave this way? Right. So it's just difficult when you're writing about real people and you don't want to reveal things about them because you don't want to invade their privacy. But if you were to do that, then they would make much more sense to a reader, you know?
Right. To have more of that story. I want to circle back to Tiffany in a minute, but you know, since this, a lot of people hearing this might not have read the new book before hearing this. How would you describe your father now? Like now that he's gone, now that you're kind of liberated, like you said, from to say some of these things, who was your father?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know about any kind of diagnostic terms, you know, but everything was about him and everything was his. If you did well, it was because of him. If you failed, it was because of you. But if you did well, it was because of him. You know, just sort of felt entitled to go up to people and make comments about their appearance, especially women, you know, to go up and say, like, if you're at McDonald's, to go up to the counter and say, hey, they're chunky. Looks like you've been having too many of your milkshakes. And you'd say, Dad, someone needs to tell her she's fat. That was his attitude. Somebody needs to tell blank, right, what their problem is. So, and he was just always there to tell you what your problem was. You know, and different people in the family can have different relationships with a parent, but, you know, he didn't like me. I mean, he never liked me and he never made any secret of it. You know, he just couldn't. I just wasn't what he had in mind. And I don't know that it was because I was gay. It's just, I just wasn't what he wanted. And I understood that early on. And I understood what that would be like. There have been young people or children in my life that I've spent time with them and then thought like, you're just nothing. You know, you're just a lump. You don't have any personality. I mean, I don't say that to them, but they're just not what I would want. Like, and I think, oh, if that was my kid, it would be really hard trying to pretend that I liked them, you know? And my father just, I don't think I was a lump. It just wasn't what he had in mind, you know, just, you know, from being unathletic and from being, you know, interested in nature and he forced me to take these guitar lessons. You know, the guy who can play the guitar, that's the life of the party. You know, that's the guy who's going to impress people. And I remember a couple of years ago, we met this woman who plays a harp. And he said, a harp? You can't bring that to a party.
That's the standard by which musical instruments are measured.
But wow. It gave me an insight into him that I thought, wow, that's who he wants to be. He wants to be the guy who walks into a room and gets all the attention. And he wants to be the guy that all eyes are on him and everybody's listening to, you know? And he couldn't stand it when I became that guy. He could not bear my success. He just did everything to undermine it that he possibly could. And it didn't, I mean, having grown up in a situation like that, there was nothing he could say that would hurt me anymore. It's just the continued effort would bother me, you know, like you're still trying this, like you're still, I mean, there's an incident in the book where, you know, I was invited to give the commencement address at Princeton. So I called my dad because he's Ivy League struck. And in fairness, I am too. You know, I thought Princeton. And I said, I don't really want to, you know, it's a pain in the ass to write graduation speeches, but I'll do this if you want to come with me. You know, are you kidding? I'd love to come. And then there was a luncheon with the president of the university beforehand. And so we go to the luncheon and my father says to the president of the university, you know, you made a real mistake here. You got David. What people wanted, they want my daughter, Amy. She's the one who you should have here. She's the one who, she'd have the crowd in the palm of her hand. And the president said, well, that's, you know, that's nice to know. And then she tried to change the subject. My father changed it back again and again and again. And then at the end of the day, when the car came to take us to New York, I said, is that why you came with me? And he said, the woman needed to know that she could have done better.
Just like McDonald's.
Right. And again, it didn't surprise me really. And it didn't hurt me. And I love my sister, Amy, you know, and Amy would be great at graduation speech. But I was always able to think like, well, it's not Amy's fault that Dad is saying this. She wouldn't want him to be doing this. But that was his whole reason for coming, was to undermine me.
And that's what a narcissistic parent or a person with narcissistic personality disorder will do to their children, because they'll pit them against each other in order to aggrandize themselves.
Well, he didn't have any brothers and sisters, so he never understood when he would talk about our relationships. We would think, you don't have any idea. It's like me talking about, I mean, I've never driven a car in my life. So it's like me talking about shifting gears into, I've absolutely no experience with it. But I think, but he did all of his life try to pit us against each other, but we liked each other. And even as kids, we realized like, it's like a pact we made, like, let's not let this mean anything. This is just his trip, you know?
The line in Happy Go Lucky that I ended up highlighting and circling and being haunted by was, as long as my father had power, he used it to hurt me. What do you carry with you today, walking around today, from the hurt that he caused you?
Gosh, I mean, I guess, a feeling that deep down I am inadequate, you know, like if somebody... It's so funny. I just got a big stack of mail sent from my publisher, right? So like hundreds and hundreds of letters, right? And I write everybody back, you know. You know, so two letters came through yesterday and both of them were like, fuck you. And, you know, I'm never reading any of your books again. And you're an asshole. And I realized later, I'm always so willing to think like, yeah, I am an asshole. And yeah, I did. But when the other letters were all lovely, you know, just kind letters from people who said, I loved your book and I love this essay in particular, or, you know, I read it to my mother when she was in her hospital bed, or my family, my entire family listened to the audiobook in the car. And I don't take that with me. But if someone says like, you're an asshole or you're a shitty writer or something like that, then I think, oh, that must be true. So the two mean ones are true, right? But the other 58 letters that I answered yesterday, those people, they don't know what they're talking about, or they're just, you know.
They're just being nice.
Yeah, yeah. But I wonder if that hasn't something to do with, you know, I wonder if that's not something I carry around. You know, just that undermining feeling that I really am as bad. I mean, my dad didn't even, you know, he wasn't a reader. He never read a book in his life. The only book I ever saw him read was called Putt to Win, right? And it was like a golfing book. So he didn't know anything about writing. So, you know, when he were to say, well, that's no good, what's he even comparing it to?
Yeah. But he must have basked in your success and Amy's success on this, you know, huge stage of the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially in terms of getting him free things.
Yeah.
Right. or if it getting him, you know, like if he, someone who worked at the Raleigh News and Observer told me every time you had a story in the New Yorker, your father would call and say, we needed to do a story about you.
Oh, wow.
But he never said that to me. And then for me to say, well, that's more about him, you know what I mean, than it is about me. That sounds like really babyish, but it's just true. I mean, the next step would have been then for them to give him a free subscription to the
newspaper. Right. Or a windbreaker or something.
Yeah.
Just ahead, David remembers his sister Tiffany.
Hi, I'm Biz, host of One Bad Mother. Whether you're a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent.
I signed my stepson up for a camp that is actually in another state. I feel really stupid, and I don't think we're going to get the money back.
And then he found out that the car manual is a book about cars, so now he's reading our car manual.
We So
join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job. Download One Bad Mother on MaximumFun.org, and yes, there will be swears.
Hi, I'm Jesse Thorne, the founder of Maximum Fun, and I have a special announcement. I'm no longer embarrassed by my brother, and me. You know, for years, each new episode of this supposed advice show was a fresh insult, a depraved jumble of erection jokes, ghost humor, and frankly, this is for the best, very little actionable advice. But now, as they enter their twilight years, I'm as surprised as anyone to admit that it's gotten kind of good. Justin, Travis, and Griffin's witticisms are more refined, like a humor column in a fancy magazine. And they hardly ever say bazinga anymore. So, after you've completely finished listening to every single one of all of our other shows, why not join the McElroy Brothers every week for My Brother, and Me?
Back with David Sedaris, beloved humorist and someone whose work sometimes pisses people off. In 2020, David did a commentary on CBS News Sunday Morning, where he proposed the idea of being able to make citizens' dismissals, kind of like citizens' arrest, but you use it to fire service workers. And David got a lot of heat for joking about making people lose their jobs during a pandemic, struck some folks as being kind of bourgeois and privileged. It was a more mild reaction, though, than when he wrote about his sister Tiffany. She died in 2013 and left notice that her family shouldn't be allowed to attend her funeral. This section of the interview gets into some accusations of sexual assault and features graphic descriptive terms. I ask David Sedaris about his relationship to the criticism he gets.
I don't seek any of that out. Like, I don't have Twitter, you know, or I don't read anything about myself. I mean, stuff gets back to me sometimes, but I feel like people who were angry about the way that I wrote about my sister Tiffany's suicide, you know, I've gotten so many letters from people who have had a family member commit suicide. So many people. And sometimes it was a son or a daughter, or it was a brother or a sister. And it's not a club that I ever thought I would be a member of, but I am a member of it. And I got to say, I really like my fellow members. But a lot of them feel they understand, you know, like there was a point when the last time I saw my sister Tiffany, I shut the door in her face. You know, I'm not proud of that. And I didn't mean to do it for the end of time. You know, I just thought I can't deal with this right now, because an encounter with her, you would think about it, you know, constantly. And I don't mean you, maybe it's different, maybe because I kind of think about things obsessively, but you would think about it every moment of the day. You would go to bed thinking about it. You would wake up in the middle of the night thinking about it. You would think about it first thing the next morning, because she would like throw acid in your face, you know, like over the slightest thing. You know, with most people, you think, okay, this is what we're having an argument about or a discussion about. I'm going to keep it within these bounds, right? But she wouldn't, and she would throw the acid in your face, and it would be, would eat away at you for months. And I was on a tour, and I couldn't give up those months. I couldn't do it. And I thought, well, maybe later. But people who have had mental illness in their family, they're like, yeah, sometimes you got to do that. You know, it's not pretty, but sometimes you got to shut the door and think, I can't do this right. You know, I have to. And it sounds very babyish to me, and it sounds very selfish, you know, to say, you know, like, I need to protect myself. But sometimes you just need to, especially if it's a mentally ill family member. And I think the people who got angry about Tiffany don't have that in their life. And they think, you know, you're always supposed to say, oh, let me come here.
What a hero they were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you go through a thing after she passed of sort of the retroactive detective work, the movie flashback of trying to collect clues and understand more about her based on experiences?
Well, it's so funny. I mean, I've been keeping a diary for 40 years, right? And so my brother, my sisters, and I were all together after Tiffany died, and I typed Tiffany into the search engine of my diary. And so I keep a diary guide, right? So most of my diary is just boring. If something happens and I think it's interesting or funny, I put it into the guide, right? So I typed Tiffany into the guide, and I read out loud everything that I had. You know, Tiffany comes home for Christmas with a black eye. Tiffany threw a lit cigarette in Gretchen's face. When it was all read out loud, it was such a portrait of a troubled, deeply troubled person, right? But for some reason, when it's under your own nose, you don't, you just think, well, that's Tiffany. You know, that's who she is. And you don't think about it that hard. But when I read it all out loud, it was like, how did we not see this coming like 50 years ago? How did we not see it coming? I mean, because I could type anyone's name. You know, I could type Hugh into the search engine too, but that's not the portrait that it doesn't set off any warning signs. You know, when I look at all of the things that I've written about him in my diary over the years.
Well, it's funny when you write about Hugh, you're right that he is a character. And so when, you know, when I'm reading something new about Hugh, I'm like, oh yeah, that matches the character I've been reading about. That fleshes out the character I've been reading about. And the same with the rest of your family. And I wonder if that made it just so much harder to write about Tiffany, and if it still makes it harder to write about Tiffany, because people who are really struggling with a mental illness are just living by a different set of rules and different set of behaviors so much of the time that it's hard to write about them.
Well, I think, you know, it was harder. Like if somebody is in denial, or somebody won't take their medication, or somebody won't do the things that they kind of need to do in order to take care of themselves, I think that makes it all the more difficult. But I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question.
Well, is Tiffany harder to write about as a character because of the world that she was living in?
Gosh, is she harder to write about as a character? You know, one of the things I didn't get across when I wrote an essay about Tiffany that was in Dress Your Family and Quarter and Denim, I think in there, I really conveyed how funny Tiffany was. I mean, she was a funny person, very funny person. And I don't think that came across in Now We Are Five. And it was something that, you know, it attracted people to her. She was the kind of person who, if you saw her at a party or something, you'd think, oh my God, that woman is funny. And then a few minutes later, you'd think, oh, she's never going to stop talking. But I think, you know, my parents sent her to this school, and it was like a reform school. In Maine, called Elan. And the judge, Tiffany had run away from home, and the judge suggested it that my parents send her to this place. And it was in Maine. And it turned out to be a horrible place. And a lot's been written about it. And a shocking number of alumni have taken their lives, people who went to school there. They were in class for only 1 hour a day. The rest of the time was spent in group. And let's say once Tiffany said something and people decided she was a fascist, so she had to wear a Nazi uniform, like stock still in a Nazi uniform, or else you would have to get in a boxing ring and box other people. And there was no one in charge. If someone ran away, everybody had to go out and find that person, right? And I remember after Tiffany came back, she was just broken. She was just broken, but she would never stop talking. Never stop talking. And then she'd been back for a year, and then she got a job there.
At the same school?
Yeah. After saying how horrible it was and everything, they hired her. And so she went there to work. And then that only lasted for 6 months.
Wow. Doing what kind of work?
Tormenting people.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my God.
I mean, the people who went, I've received letters and I've met with a couple of people who went there, and it was horrible.
Yeah. How much did she open up about it to you? Like, how much did...
Oh, very. Very. I mean, when she came back, there was only talk of that. But she wasn't allowed to phone home. She wasn't allowed, my parents weren't allowed to visit. I wrote her letters, and then she wrote and asked me to stop. But in one of the situations, you know, I was doing a lot of collages back then. You know, I was like 20 years old. And I later learned that in group, they brought one of my letters in a collage that I'd sent her into group. And I had glued the collage to a board game, right? I went to a thrift store and there was a board game. And so I cut a square of the cardboard off the board game and used that to glue stuff onto. And it was a game called What Should I Wear, apparently, right? And so it said, what should I wear? And then there was a girl, but her head was cut, you know, I cut it in such a way that her head was cut off. It was just an accident. And that's what they talked about in group, the back of the collage, that your brother wants to cut your head off. Your brother thinks you don't deserve to have a head. And it was sort of like sending somebody a letter and then looking at the postmark on the stamp and then saying that that looks like it's a mustache on the stamps, you know, like if it's a stamp with the Statue of Liberty on it, you know, that that looks like a mustache on the Statue of Liberty. So I'm saying that all women should become men. It was just ridiculous. It was just, they weren't, didn't talk about the letter I wrote her. They didn't talk about what the collage was of. They talked about the back of it, which was just, which was nothing. It was not even anything I'd noticed. It was just a piece of cardboard.
Did Tiffany believe that you wanted to cut off her head?
Whatever the people in group were talking about. Tiffany was like me in a lot of ways. And so that was one of the reasons why Tiffany was like my mom in a lot of ways. And so that was why she and my mom never got along. And she was like me in a lot of ways as well. I wonder where that knocking is coming from.
I don't know. Maybe you should let them in.
They're doing some work on the apartment. They're doing some work here.
That's okay.
And Tiffany was like me in that we could experience something and then have a good time. And then later when someone asks us about it, it's all negative, you know? And part of it is it's funnier to complain about stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just funnier to take something and turn it into a misadventure. But it's also really irritating to the people who were there and were like, wait a minute, I thought we were having a good time. So Tiffany was more extreme in that than I was. But, you know, you could have a visit with her and you'd think, wow, that was great. That went really well. And then you would hear about she couldn't wait for you to leave and that you were mean to her and you were, you know, I mean, Tiffany accused my father of sexually abusing her. And as the years passed, she got much more vocal about that. She never gave examples, but she claimed to remember her coming into his room in the middle of the night, into her room in the middle of the night. And you'd say, well, what did he do? I never said he fucked me. That's not what I said. I never said he fucked me. Okay. I never told anybody that he fucked me. Okay. And then what did he do? I didn't say he fucked me. So you never kind of got a, but then she said that I sexually abused her as well, which, you know, I can't speak for my father, but I know that I never sexually abused my sister. I mean, maybe my idea of sexual abuse is too textbook, you know, when I'm thinking that it would mean like putting something in somebody's vagina or touching their vagina or their breasts or their ass or, you know, mauling them in some way or harassing them or encouraging other people to. I have to say, I really cannot think of one time when I even came close to that. I mean, that was an asshole sometimes, but so was she. So was everybody.
What do you do now with this pain that's left over from people who have died, from your father and from your sister? Do you go to therapy about it? Are you trying to forget it? Are you trying to contextualize it? Like, what do you do with this repository of pain?
I think everybody lives with a repository of pain. I mean, I think that that's something you realize as you grow older. You know, when I look at somebody like my boyfriend, Hugh, his mother, gee, when I think about all of the brothers and sisters she's had who have died and the parents who have died and the good friends who have died. And when you think about how much pain anybody, you know, who's made it to 92 years old lives with, you know, it's just like another stone put on your back. But surprisingly, you support the weight of it. Surprisingly, you bear it. And you just know there's just more in the future, right?
But don't you think there's a decision that ends up being made, though, of like how you're going to carry it? Like, are you going to just say, I'm moving on? Are you going to dig deep into it? Are you going to try to forget about it? Like, even doing nothing about it is a decision that you make about it, don't you think?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm right. You know, I mean, that's how I try to make sense of the world, is that I write, like, not just essays, but I write in my diary. And then I read over what I've written and I think, wow, that's wrong. Or that feels about right. But I've never been to a therapist before. I don't know. I guess I just always broke the world into two categories, like people who pay someone to listen to their problems and people who get paid for telling the world their problems. And so I just always put myself in the second category, you know?
Wow. Okay.
I had a boyfriend once, and long before Hugh, and he and I, it was really kind of time for us to break up. And he said, well, why don't we go to a couples therapist? Right. And the idea was for him to go, for us to go separately and then for us to go together. Right. And the going together part never materialized. And we saw the person separately maybe 5 or 6 times. And I know that I didn't want to be boring. So I would rehearse what I was going to do. And I put a little act together, you know.
Sure.
And I'd do my act once a week. And now I look back and she must have been like, oh my God, I guess I'll drop the act eventually.
He's workshopping new material.
Yeah. But I didn't want to be boring. Uh-huh. And I just feel like problems like mine, they're boring. My father was mean to me and he never really liked me. I like other people talking about it. You know, I'm happy to hear about other people talking about it. Well, I mean, within reason. But I mean, I guess I just think if I am going to talk about it, I want it to be funny. You know, I want laughs. If I'm going to write an essay about it, then I want laughs, right? I don't want... What the hell? Hugh? Can you give me a second?
Sure.
Can we find out what that knocking
yes.
is? I think it's coming from upstairs.
Okay. Yep, we find out. Huh.
I think we'll be wrapping soon, but...
isn't that just always the way?
Yeah. I think it lends some like dramatic immediacy to the conversation, though. Like we have to get the insight before the Cossacks invade. Oh, That seemed to take care of it.
No, it's still going.
Okay.
But if I'm going to write about something, you know, even the essay I wrote about Tiffany accusing my father of sexually abusing her, there are laughs in there. You know, they're not laughs about that, but they're laughs about other things inside the essay, because I insist on it, I suppose.
I'm going to wrap anyway, because this is a good place. So I'm going to just let the contractor, I'm just going to accept, accept the pain of the contractor.
They're tuck pointing my building.
Uh-huh.
And so there are a whole crew of people like pounding on everything all the time. And they will be for months, I suppose.
Just in time for COVID.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, good luck with that. David Sedaris, congratulations on Happy Go Lucky, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And no, that was not Hugh talking just there. It was David's assistant, Catherine. No word on whether the renovations in his building were completed or how they turned out. We'll keep you posted. Please understand that I'm not here to say that David does or does not deserve criticism for what he writes about his sister or his father or anything else. I'm not in a position to support or oppose any charges Tiffany made against David and the Sedaris family. I do relate to what David says and has written about how things with Tiffany felt to him. As you may know, I lost my brother Rick to suicide in 2007. Rick had a lot of difficult things in his life. He had dealt with a substance use disorder for much of his life, methamphetamine most notably. I would lose track sometimes of where he was living, how to get in touch with him, if he even had a home or a job at any given time. He said he was in recovery in the later years of his life, but a lot of damage had been done to his health. And I often had the same feeling, I think, that David did from dealing with his sister, where you just don't know what to do. You don't know how to help, or if you even can help, you don't know what to do next. Family relationships can be hard. Family relationships with a lot of pain are perhaps exceptionally hard for the rest of everyone's life. Hard in the way complex math is hard, but also hard in the way a 2x4 feels when someone hits you with it. And when that family member dies, another thing that dies is the hope of ever really figuring them out. I was in radio for a very long time, and part of why I like being in podcasting is you can do things that you could never do in radio, like extended periods of silence. People won't think you've gone off the air, and an engineer won't come charging into the studio. So that's nice. And that's what we'll do once again today with Laura House with our meditation moment. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Ah, silence. Good old quietness. That's where all the enlightenment is hiding, in those silences, or in your breath, or in something. Anyway, let's have you go there with us and see what we can find in that silence.
Yeah, at the very least, it's better than getting a bunch of bad news or doom scrolling.
Right, or traffic reports.
Yeah. There's so many. There's a lot less bad news here. So
right.
We just close your eyes. First, get comfortable. Really, the first step one, be comfortable. Sit in a chair or sofa or whatnot. Have your back supported, your head up. Close your eyes and just notice your breath. Your breath is happening. It's been happening all day, probably yesterday and the days before. Just notice it easily. You're not trying to grab hold of it or anything. And you'll have thoughts, and when you become aware that your attention is in your thoughts, you just gently, just easily notice your breath again, sort of glancing in the direction of your breath. And just let go. see what happens. You can go ahead and slowly open your eyes.
You know what I really appreciate is that once a week on these things, I can realize how high up my shoulders are towards my ears regularly.
Yeah.
Because they finally descend to where they ought to be.
Yeah, there's something about the... And I meditate quite a bit.
Yeah.
But I still, when I do, I close my eyes and it's like you're... From the inside, this is the whole world now. Does that make sense? It's like you're kind of shutting everything out and you're just noticing your breath. And suddenly I'm very aware of my toes and their position,
right,
or fingers, or like maybe I'm making a little foot fist or, you know, like, yeah, you do notice those and you just naturally like it finally feels safe to like, oh, I guess I can drop those shoulders down.
It's like a muscle memory thing of like, oh, okay, I'm in this space. Now yeah. I can relax some of these things. It's like your body is taking a cue off of the sound almost, or off of the breath or something.
Yeah, that's a really cool way to think about it. It is like, if you think of it as, oh, this is my little safe space. If you maybe just think of meditation moments as your private panic room where everything is safe. You just run in there. Oh, I'm fine in here. And you just let go.
I'm not sure if that really establishes the tone I want.
Meditation panic room. It may be a thing.
Look, there's a spiritual burglar in your house. And
isn't there always?
Isn't there always? And Laura House is our security system. You can find Laura at the Tiny Victories podcast with Annabelle Gurwitch. And you can find her online at laurahouse.com. Laura, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, he makes some dark and twisted comedy for TV, writes and performs serious heartfelt music, and performs stand-up as a character who is just the biggest asshole around. And he uses the name Tim Heidecker for all those characters.
You know, it's been a decade building this persona with Eric, you know, projects under my own name that were intentionally confusing and intentionally layered with irony and masks and things. But it was interesting to me. There's like, oh, I could actually now be myself, and that would be a new character, you know?
Tim Heidecker, the real one, joins us. If people support our show, we can keep having a show. That's the way it works. If people stop supporting it, and we got to stop. I don't want to stop. So if you've already donated, thank you. If you haven't already, now is the time. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join. Find a level that works for you. Help us out. Help get these shows out into the world. Be sure to hit subscribe on this program. Write reviews. Give us 5 stars. That all helps get the word out. The Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free. 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter, @JohnMo. I wrote a book called The Hilarious World of Depression. Where did I ever think of that title? It's a memoir. There's stuff about mental health in there. There's stuff about my life. There's stories. There's a lot of laughs in it, really, and I think you'll enjoy it. You can find it wherever books are sold on account of it's a book. Don't look for it where milk is sold. It's probably not there. Hello, credits listeners. If you put a frog in a pot of tepid water and turn up the water to the point that it's boiling, the frog will jump out. Because of course it will. Come on. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hi, this is your friend in the Pacific Northwest. You showed up today, and that's good enough.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.